둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hey, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell.
Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from County Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back for season four. I'm Peter Chidi of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcasts and join me for the story behind the song.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays, decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa, got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments, Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels, Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org. Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks for making your way here. Check out the episode. You know how this works. If you're not already, hit that subscribe button. You're going to get new interviews just like this one sent your way every single week at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org. Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. We've had some great guests dropping by lately. Just talked with Zinde Murdoch of The Runarounds, both the band and the Amazon Prime video show. Darcy Carden was just here. But love Darcy Carden. She did a cameo, a little guest starring, I guess, in the latest season of Loot on Apple TV. Juliana Hadfield to talk about her 20th album, Lightning Might Strike. Lou Graham, lead singer of Foreigner. Gobo Fraggle, the Fraggle himself, as well as Fraggle Rock showrunner John Tartaglia dropped in to talk about the first snow of Fraggle Rock. Sarah Bareilles, one of our favorite songwriters, who she did the lead song to the Apple TV documentary Come See Me in the Good Light about Andrea Gibson's final days in poetry. Gaden Matarazzo, he plays Dustin in Stranger Things. We got to discuss the final season. Felicity Jones, Carrie Condon to talk about Train Dreams. That's what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. And that's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, I get to catch up with Paul Feig. He was just here not too long ago to talk about the movie Jackpot he did with John Cena and Awkwafina. This time around, we're talking about The Housemaid. In fact, he adapted The Housemaid from the from Freda McFadden's bestseller. It stars Sydney Sweeney, Amanda Seyfried, Brandon Skelnar, Michael Marone, and Elizabeth Perkins, and follows a struggling woman, played by Sydney Sweeney, who is happy to start over as a housemaid for an affluent elite couple. Suspense is the genre, and we're going to talk about shaping its sly tonal shift from fun unsettling to full-on psychological thriller, and why he ultimately added entire pieces to the story that actually aren't in the book. Paul's going to dig into the dual POV structure, explain his aversion to lazy voiceovers, and break down how the film balances an hour of questions with an hour of answers. He'll also get into building nuanced female-led stories, as he's done in Bridesmaids to Ghostbusters to A Simple Favor, collaborating with wildly good-looking casts and letting actors define their characters through wardrobe and posture. And because this is Paul Feig, we're also going to talk about martinis, how he slipped them into the movie this time. All that and more as we're talking about The Housemaid in theaters. It's Kyle Meredith with Paul Feig.
Hey, Kyle. How you doing?
I'm good. It's good to see you again.
Yeah, you too. You too. How you been?
I'm all right. Congrats on another fine film you've made.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I'm very proud.
Yeah. So this one, we get adapted from the book, right? Like when you get something like this, like how close to the source material do you want to stay? Because you pull off this really interesting, it's like a fun, unsettling tone for most of it.
Yeah, I mean, the book's really good, you know, and the book is so popular and it already been on the bestseller list for like a year and a half when I came to the project. So it was knowing, yeah, let's not mess with it too much. Let's just make sure that we make it as cinematic as we can and make it work on the screen as well as it can. But, you know, I hadn't read the book. I got sent the script first that Rebecca Sonnenschein did the adaptation of. And that really pulled me in. And then I was able to then go and read the book and go, I know, Rebecca, you had to, shorten things to get it into a screenplay size. But now let's bring this back. Let's bring that back. And then she was able to work it in. And, you know, she did a brilliant job with it.
I'd love, like, is that tone there? Because you do go from this. Like the first part of the movie, it's what do you call it? It's not camp. It's not the word I'm looking for. But there's this shift in tone that goes from like, am I watching a caricature of something, and then almost to like nearly a horror movie.
Yeah. I mean, that's what drew me in to this, is that we spend the first hour making you root for everything you're not supposed to be rooting for, and then we make you pay for it in the second hour. But that tone was always, it's in the book, because the book is written in a very funny, I'm not going to say snarky way, but there is a snarkiness about the way that Millie relates, because it's all, you know, Freda McFadden's books in her writing is so brilliant because she does a lot of first person narration. So the whole first half of the book is Millie's voice and how she's reacting. So you're in Millie's head and you don't know what's going on with Nina. And then the second half of the book, now you're in Nina's point of view, in Nina's head, and you're hearing her side of the story. And so it's really fun, because all my movies, I'm always very hung up on, like, it has to be one person's point of view. Mm-hmm. So reading this, I was like, oh, this is the one of the times that this actually, I'm not going to do that. And I think it works great, because as my producing partner, Laura Fisher, says, this movie, the first hour is all questions and the second hour is all answers.
That's interesting.
And I think it's really satisfying for an audience to do that, to get that.
And we'll be right back right after this.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays, decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa, got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments, Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels, Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Cozy traditions feel good, especially this time of year. And that includes your fall makeup look. From lashes for days with liquid lash extension mascara to enhancing a smoky eye with your favorite shade of Brilliant Eye Brightener, Thrive Cosmetics is your go-to for completing every fall look. Whether you want a simple, just gotta get out the door routine or fall glam that wows at all your favorite festivities, you'll always look and feel radiant with Thrive Cosmetics. Plus, every product is vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients. Complete your fall look. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/cozy for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics. CAUSEMETICS.com/cozy.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Paul Feig.
Speaking of, you know, your style in your movies, I mean, you've carved out a great run of actress-led films that you've been on. Is that chance? Is that something you look for?
Yeah, I just love telling women's stories, and I love working with actresses. And you know, there's, you know, it's plenty of movies about men. So, you know, I'm always just looking for like great three-dimensional portrayals of women, you know, in whatever genre it's in that I feel that I can put my voice and my stamp on. So I'm just more interested in that. That's all I kind of seek out in our company. We're just always looking for women's stories, basically, or female led stories.
Right. Right. And speaking of one of those, by the way, the great Elizabeth Perkins.
Oh my God.
Who's brilliant always. And her, I mean, she is the representation of unhealthy, toxic bonds in this movie, at least there. I'd love to hear about working with her on this and the direction you gave her, because you can use some cliche term like ice queen, and it's very icy demeanor. But what were you hoping to get from her?
Well, I mean, I love Elizabeth. We worked together, and you know, I first met and worked with her on Weeds when I directed a bunch of those, and then she was in Ghostbusters, you know, and she was not in the theatrical one, but she's in the extended cut, and then she, you know, stepped into Jean Smart's role in Another Simple Favor. So I know her really well, and honestly, for this, I didn't give her much direction. I mean, she came in with that character set, that icy kind of, you know, oh, you know, this is how you allow the help to dress in your house. She's kind of spooky, you know, like the way she's, yes. You know, and it's, yeah, I was just kind of like, wow, Elizabeth, I love what you're doing. Keep doing it. So, you know, it was a couple of times I would be kind of like just stare at her for a long time. I did a lot of that on this movie for some reason, like with Amanda's character, too. I'm always going like, just stare at people for a long time before you say anything, because it's so unnerving. You know,
it is unnerving.
Like that to you. And Elizabeth is so good at it with that. Just and she wanted it. You know, that's kind of her hair is sort of that color now. And I was like, oh, let's just, you know, let's stick with that. And then she came up with kind of how it's styled and all that. You know, I really let my actors set their looks with, you know, the costume department and with makeup and hair and all that. And, you know, I'm part of it, but I'm more kind of like, what do you want? What do you want to do? Cool. I love that. You know, go ahead and do it.
Right. I'm sure a lot of actors really appreciate the kind of relationship.
You know, I mean, I was an actor for a long time. Mm-hmm. And what some directors and other department heads don't realize is that what you're wearing and what you look like is as much a part of your research and your, you know, comfortableness with the character as is the lines and the setting. So if you jam somebody in a costume and they don't feel like the character, that you're hurting the actor by doing that.
I mean, that does, I don't know if I'd say half the job, but so much of the job right there is the costume. I mean, that puts you in the frame of mind. It sounds obvious to say, but right.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I also want to say, I don't know if the criteria for casting here was everybody has to be unbelievably good looking. Like even the gardener is like the greatest best looking gardener you've ever seen in your life.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. I got a good looking cast. There was times I like John Schwartzman, my DP and I were just like, wow, this is a good looking cast, you know, and it's nice because you can shoot them from any angle, too. You know, there's not any of this like raise that camera up and don't be at this angle. They're just beautiful no matter where you shoot them. So I'm able to do my thriller stuff. Let's get down low and all this, you know, which some actors don't love when you do it.
Don't shoot them down here. Right. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. Which is the worst thing you can ever say to a director is like, please. Don't tell me where I can put the camera.
Speaking of looking, by the way, there's one shot. We're in the restaurant, and this is beautiful shot of two martinis.
You know, it's one of my movies if there's a martini in it.
I thought, I don't know if this was in the script, but this feels very Paul right now.
Yeah, no, I that's my, those are my cameos, is really my martinis and my gin, which my gin bottle is hidden all over the place too.
I love that. I love the little hallmarks. Like any director can leave those. Yeah.
Well, I'm very specific about my martinis and especially the twists. And, you know, the prop department brought out these two martinis with those little curly Q pigtail, you know, kind of lemon twist. I'm like, get that out of here. Bring me a lemon and a knife. I'm going to show you how to do this big twist. That's how you do it.
Do you get an extra credit for that? Some kind of set credit?
There should be. Props? There should be like lemon wrangler or something. That's right.
Were there things that you had to cut from the book? Like when I saw the diary, I think I expected more of the diary and then wondered later, I was like, I wonder if there was more of the diary.
Well, no, the diary wasn't even in the book.
Oh, okay.
The thing was, you know, I'm really weird about voiceover because I think it can be used as a crutch a lot of times. So to me, voiceover has to be justified. And so that's why we came up with, you know, for Millie, it's the journal that her parole officer says should be doing a journal. And then for Nina, it's writing the letter to Cece.
I see.
Yeah.
So that gave you the allowance right there.
Yeah. Cause then you go, oh, now I know why this person's just talking to me out of the blue, because there was a few things in our original script where you would just hear Millie just say something like in response to Nina, like this woman's crazy or something. And I was like, no, we can't have any of that in because that's not something she would be writing. You know, it has to be something that is in the moment she's writing. We had a few more diary scenes and we took them out, but no, the book, honestly, we added to the book. We added the ending because the book ends, I don't know, spoilers, but it kind of ends before the movie does. It ends very satisfyingly in the book, but it's not cinematic enough for the movie. And so we were able to add that. But then at the same time, Nina's story in the book is told in a much snarkier way. And we knew we needed to rebuild everybody's love for Nina in that section because you just hate her guts by the middle of the movie. And so what I love is by the end of the movie, you're in love with Nina again, you know, because you realize, oh, this poor woman, what she went through.
Not an easy task and all the puzzle pieces you have to do for a movie. Which you did beautifully, as usual. Seriously, congratulations on this and seeing it on the big screen and everything else.
We're back in theaters.
Back in theaters.
Right.
Paul, it's such a pleasure as always to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Kyle, good to talk to you, man.
And we'll be right back right after this.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith. So I want to also include my most recent conversation with Paul. Well, the most recent one before this that came out in 2024, when we got to talk about his movie Jackpots with John Cena and Awkwafina, part two of Kyle Meredith with Paul Feig.
Hey, Kyle. How are you doing, man?
Hey, man. Congrats on Jackpot. I was looking around at what you've been up to right now, and I... You just get back from Italy for shooting one thing, go immediately into promotion for something you shot before that as you're getting ready to start on another project that's in the news. How you doing?
I'm great. When I'm working, nobody's happier than myself. I love to work. You know, I tried my whole life to get to make movies, and there was one point where it didn't seem like they're going to let me make movies anymore. So I love to do it.
And that's all it takes, right? Is just that moment where you think this could all go away.
Oh, yeah. If you've been in movie jail once, man, you do not want to go back.
Well, this is such a fun movie. This is one of those movies where I immediately, like if I were 15, 16, I probably would have watched it three or four times in one weekend, memorized all the lines. Now in my 40s, I have to go back and with a pencil and paper to remember.
Sucks getting older, right? You'll always be younger than me, my friend. Just remember that, Ryan.
What was I hearing about, though? You said this, like you guys did this in 40 days. The shoot itself was 40, a quick shoot? Is that right?
Yeah, very challenging. That was the hardest part about this movie, is we really didn't have enough time. But we did it. We pulled it off. I mean, thank God for my great stunt team, headed up by the great James Young, who does a lot of the Marvel stuff. But they were so organized and able to come in and help us out with the stuff that we couldn't get with the main unit and you know, get extra, our second unit stuff that we needed, and just get some of the stunt gags that didn't require my cast. So we all pitched in and got it done. And I'm so happy with the final product.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've been through just about every scenario at this point, but when you've got such a, I don't know, high octane movie like this, but in such a limited amount of time, like how much does that affect the actual job for you? Do you get the rush out of it? Does it help at all?
Yeah, you know, I like what I call runaway freight trains. You know, I always look for projects that are like ready to get going, or if something we're developing, like sell it and then like put it on a very tight schedule, at least to get it done. I mean, sometimes it's nice to have a little more breathing room when you're actually shooting the movie, but sure. There is an energy that comes from moving fast. And, you know, and I still, even though we're on a short schedule, I still do what's called French hours, some call the continuous hours, which is we only work 10 hour day with no lunch or anything. There's food being passed around, but we never stop. So the energy of that, I think you get more done than you do on a 16 hour day with a lunch and meal penalties and all that kind of thing, because you're in it, you're focused, you're doing it, and then by the time everybody's tired, you go home.
You're making the argument for the 4 hour or 4 day work week. That's what I'm hearing.
That's a little tight for my taste.
But it seems like you've really found this great footing in action comedy. I mean, you know, over the past few, of course, you're doing other things too, but you know, it's part of your greatest hits, I think, is what's happening here. Like, what is it about it that attracts, other than what I would say fighting seems like it lends itself to being funny anyway?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely that. I think physical comedy is great, but I also think action comedy is fun because there's so much else that you're hanging the comedy on. And the main thrust of it is not the comedy, it is the dramatic underpinning of the story, of the characters, of the character arcs, and then you just build the comedy up from there. But, you know, I always say that my movies are dramas that are funny because, you know, you have to have that dramatic core. You know, when you see movies that are just all comedy and all jokes, they're really fun. But, you know, there's a moment sometimes you look at your watch like, okay, I'm just kind of going joke to joke here. Well, I'm not invested in this. And what an action comedy does also, if it's not done silly, is that you are pulled along by your fear of these characters being hurt or being killed. That's why you can't have a funny villain. You can have a villain who has funny moments, but you can't have a silly villain. And so, you know, and that's why I love Simu Liu in this movie, is he's, you know, he's really intimidating, but he can land some really good jokes. I mean, his run about LaCroix is one of my favorite joke runs I've ever had in a movie.
When you're saying that, of course, I'm going back in my head, and you're completely right. I was even, like, I've heard you talk about, obviously, Jackie Chan, I think, you know, was a big part of this, but even the Three Stooges. And earlier today, I was watching, what was it? It was Abbott and Costello meets Dr. Jekyll and Hyde.
I grew up watching those movies.
Yeah, I was just thinking there's so many different versions of like comedy duo, you know, and movie monster, whatever. I'm pretty sure that's the correct combination of it.
Yeah.
But even the physical comedy that comes out of that, and thinking like they had that so perfect, you know, we're coming out nearly 100 years ago is what we're looking at, over 100 years ago for some of it, if you're mm-hmm. looking at Chaplin, mm-hmm. you know, and then you come into a movie like this and maybe you don't have to reinvent the wheel, but you got to find what's, you know, fresh. I mean, how much is that a part of the equation?
It's a huge part of the equation. I mean, you know, people won't put up with like an old idea, or it's really hard to get people excited about that. Execution is definitely a big part of things. And as they, you know, say, there's only 7 stories in the world, or however they break that down, really, and it's all variations off of that. But, you know, it's, you have to have a fresh idea in the middle of it. That's when I first read this script. I was like, this is great, because there's a really insanely high stakes core of this, which is you will get killed, you know, and then somebody who doesn't even know what's going on accidentally gets put in the situation where they are the target. Right there, you've got the audience is sitting forward like, oh my God, what's going to happen? So then I can just hang all this comedy on it. You know, comedy works the best when there's danger, you know, and if it's a romantic comedy, there's a danger of being sad, of having your life fall apart, of whatever. And in action comedy, it's about the danger you're going to get killed. And that just raises everything so much in a way that, you know, just a joke fest doesn't.
Hey, I love that it's set sort of close enough in the future with everything that's happening today that seems like that could be possible. Well, like, I don't think it's going to get there, obviously, suspension of belief, but that could be possible.
Right.
You know, like, because anything's possible at this point. Like, yeah. What was it, the Depression of 2026?
Oh, yeah.
I think is what we...
Great Depression,
you know,
of 2026.
Like, oh, man. I don't need that part right now, but...
I know, exactly. You got to go dark to get light, you know?
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. But, like, but it is one of those things, like, how far can you take it without it getting too real,
To me, the big thing when I read this script that made me go, I have to do this, other than loving the whole concept, was the fact that Rob Yescom, who wrote it, put in that the only rule is that there's no guns. And I think if there's guns were allowed in this, it'd be a much different movie. And I think it'd be a less fun movie. I think it would be kind of an ugly movie. But that's what made me happy. It was like, okay, cool. So we're just down to primal, grab what you can and try to take somebody out. And then it levels the playing field too. Because, you know, if it was all guns, you go like, well, she's dead. And so if it's just a lot of people shooting and missing, then okay, well, that's, you know, we've all seen episodes of Cannon where with his little gun, he can shoot guys and nobody can seem to hit this big guy running around. You know, so that's the kind of thing that I think makes it... makes you buy into it and not be so worried about the person that you can't enjoy yourself. You know, again, we're still a comedy, so you want to have the ability to people to have fun even though they're worried.
And without giving anything away, the other thing I really loved about the wrap up is, while there is a wrap up and there seems to be some lessons learned by people, as an overall, it's not like the world becomes a better place. Like these dipshits are still going to be dipshits.
Right.
You know, yeah. I feel like by the end of it.
Yeah, no, totally. You know, I mean, it's really about finding humanity in the middle of a sort of inhuman situation. And the thing I love about this concept, unlike The Purge, which nobody loves those movies more than me. I really think those movies are great. But in The Purge, everyone's in it. Nobody in society has an exit card. So it's terrifying. This, you voluntarily join up. So if you're somebody who is desperate enough or thinks you're enough of a badass to get in there and either win the lottery and fend off everybody from killing you, or you're going to get in there and take out whoever did it, whoever wins, that's your choice. And so I think that, to me, makes it a little less dark, because we're not saying all humanity sucks. We're just saying there's just a portion of humanity that's probably a little less moral than the rest of us.
And I believe that. I believe that. Of course, John Cena and Awkwafina, I mean, they're perfect pairing. How did you land on them? I mean, did they have them? Like, was that the idea from the beginning? How does that process work?
Well, I was very lucky, because when the script was sent to me, they were already attached. So talk about getting a great script, nice. A great idea, and two amazing cast members right out of the gate. But I have to say, if they weren't attached, I think I would have ended up casting both of them, because they're just perfect for the role. You know, I mean, Nora is so funny, but she's so relatable, and she's, you know, such a surrogate for the audience. And the fact that she hasn't, even though she's been in action movies, she hasn't really done action. I had no interest in putting somebody in the lead of this who we've seen kick ass before, because what fun is that? You know, the fun of this is, like, this is a normal person who's suddenly in way over their head, who has to learn how to fight on the fly. And then John, what I love about John is he's not coming in as this sort of toxic, masculine, you know, superhero. He's coming in as this sweet guy who just wants to do the right thing. He just happens to be a big, gentle giant of a guy who's willing to fight, but he's also not willing to hurt anybody. He really wants to make sure he's just doing enough to keep them away from her. So it makes it, I want everything in my career to be good-natured, even if it can get super dark in the middle. It always needs to kind of have a positive message at the end.
You still want to put the helmet on the person before you throw them out of the car.
Put the helmet on the person. You're not a monster. Just get them out of the car.
Was the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles song in the script?
Yeah, that was scripted in. Full disclosure, I'm not a Teenage Mutant Ninja, knowledgeable person, but I just thought it was such a funny runner for him, and we added it in a few more times just because I thought it was a funny character thing for him. And so the fact that he's, comparing himself to, one of the, he's not Donatello.
He's Michelangelo.
Michelangelo, yeah. Exactly. Thank you so much. And so we had a lot of fun with it just because there's something funny to me about, having been a loyal Comic-Con goer for 30 years and growing up as a sci-fi nerd, adults who are still into that stuff. I have a special place in my heart because I'm one of those people. And so I just thought it was really fun. I just think it's so fun that the idea of a big, giant guy like John Cena is obsessed with the Mutant Ninja Turtles.
So I come at it from the music nerd side of things.
With the partners in crime.
Even in that world, that's sort of a deeper cut, even in the musical landscape of that world, the Ninja Turtles. So
yeah.
That's
we go deep. Like, some of our wrestlers are deep. My favorite weird thing that we have is that Nora's character in her audition chooses to do the Samuel Jackson monologue from Deep Blue Sea, which the audiences never laugh at it when the woman goes like, "Is that from Deep Blue Sea?" And I think it's the funniest joke in the world. So I know there's some people out there that get it.
Yeah, and that'll mean the world to them. But it was that deep of a cut.
Exactly.
I love that. And you had Sean William Scott playing First Girl, and the whole thing, and MGK, which I'm always surprised at how much I enjoy seeing him in film roles.
MGK is such a super talented guy who people want to sometimes put down, and I think he's the greatest. He is so smart and funny and so open. He, we got a call from his people, like he's kind of interested in doing something like this. I was like, really? Because I was trying to think of who to put in that cameo. We had a few people we were thinking about. And, but he also like, oh, it's a rock star. Is he going to say, he always want to do this and do that? He showed up. He was ready for anything. And you see the movie. Shoot the guy in the face. We drag him downstairs. We throw him in a pool. you got to have a good sense of humor to be put through that.
Yeah, did you see him in Cameron Crowe's Roadies? Like, he was the heart of that show, and that's what caught me by surprise.
Oh no, I never saw that. I saw Good Morning, which I really think is really fun.
I mean, guy's multi-talented.
Yeah,
You hate him when they're that talented. You love them and you hate them.
There you go.
All that to say, Jackpot is so good. And just watching all the other stuff you're doing and your drinks, I wanted to say, is it fair to say that a martini is the greatest drink of all time?
Yeah, it's the only true statement in the world. There is nothing better than a good, cold, dry martini.
Would it destroy you if I said that lately I've been doing my dirty with vodka?
I'm ending the interview now. I'm sorry. It's all over. That's okay. I'll let it go. At least you got the dirty in there, so at least you're tasting something. Because vodka doesn't have any taste. It's made to not have any flavor. So if you have a vodka martini, you're just basically having water that can get you drunk with a little bit of vermouth in it. So that's all I'm saying.
No, I get it. I'm based in Louisville, as Kentucky. So of course we're bourbon cup country, and the whole thing, like, you don't put the mixers. And I love bourbon.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's my thought, is like, am I completely bastardizing this martini? And here I am
with the
doing
dirt,
the thing that we're not supposed to do.
No, there's nothing wrong with the dirt. Just take the vodka out and put it in the gin. Yeah. Then you'll be much happier. And put in Ardingstall's Brilliant London Dry Gin, because that's the best. Because that's mine.
I appreciate that. I'm gonna be doing it. Left to say, Simple Favor 2, I know, is the next big thing, and we're so excited to see that 6 years later. Like, did you maybe think that there was this, is this the first sequel you've done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. First sequel. Nothing. I never wanted to do a sequel before, but I had an idea for this, and I love those characters. And it was just like, maybe we do have more to tell with them. And I'm so happy that we did it, because I'm in the middle of my director's cut, but we did our first test screening last week, and it scored really, really high. So it's a lot of fun. I'm really, really happy with it. It's as nuts as you think it should be.
It's really interesting when you have that opportunity. Like, I think I'm surprised. I'm as surprised in the folks who say I don't like to do sequels, that the story's done, as I am surprised in the people that would just be tempted all the time to continue those stories.
Yeah, you know,
for all their characters.
No, I mean there's definitely a seduction about doing sequels and continuing a story, especially when you're in the middle of something. Because in your middle of it, you're so in love with your cast and you're having such a good time, you're so creatively in that world that you're like, let's do the next one. But it's only once you kind of finish the whole process that either you're like, we got to do another one, or you're most of the time like, okay, I need to break from that, you know? And it's not that you didn't have a good time, it's just kind of, you know, you want to try new things, or I do, you know? So sometimes when I see people who are just doing, you know, who are in the big machine and doing them one after another, I know they're having a good time, but at the same time, I'm like, I'm glad I'm not doing that at the moment, just because it's really fun to create a new situation, you know, with new characters. It's fresh. It's like, you know, getting new friends. I don't know. It's really fun.
Then you wait about 10 years and you do it then.
Or 6 years, like I did with Simple Favor.
6 years, you know, something. What is statute of limitation? There's got to be something in there where it's like, okay, now it's cool. Now it's fine.
I know.
Now
you can do it. I guess we started the process about 3.5 years in, so not so bad.
I'll let you handle the math.
There you go. my head will explode.
Seriously, Paul, congratulations on Jackpot. It's such a fun movie. I'm so happy you got to be a part of this. And I'm always looking forward to what you do next. So
thanks
for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much. And more fun to come.
And my thanks to Paul, the housemaid. Look for it in theaters. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Hit that subscribe button before you get out of here to keep up with all the interviews that I put out every single week at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With, and please do leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening from. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday, starting 6 p.m. Eastern, 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music. There are bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. One of my recent shows features some classics and favorites from the White Stripes, Dean Spencer, Cake, The Band, Tom Waits, Tears for Fears, David Bowie, Mr. Big, Brandi Carlile, Sam Phillips, Big Thief, Ice House, Lucinda Williams, Joan Shelley, Spoon, and my interviews with Erica Christensen, Penelope Ann Miller, and the legendary John Malkovich. That's what you can hear when you tune in weeknights starting 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always at Kyle Meredith. Please do like, follow along. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.